So there's an expression in Japan, which is one of the most useful things, you know, one of the first things you learn when you move there. It's otsukare sama deshita, which means thank you for your efforts. And so I say to each of you, you know, as we move into the heart of the retreat, you know, I have a lot of appreciation for you, and it's very meaningful for me to meet you in the practice discussions, and I love it. So I hope you're you may not be loving it every moment, but that's the topic of the talk today. you know, in a way, there's a beautiful simplicity to this practice. You know, we keep talking about over and over. Just to be here. Just to enter this moment fully. Without needing to change it in any way. To be present with our experience without being in conflict with it. So it sounds really simple, yet it's not easy. And or maybe it's not easy to trust something that's so simple. You know, various difficulties arise. The mind flies off into fantasy, into memory, into old hurts, you know, old patterns of thinking. You know, so sometimes it can feel like being stuck in the mud or stuck in quicksand. And so not to mention the sleepiness, the restlessness, the fidgeting, the doubts. You know, why am I doing this? Why, you know, this is stupid, you know. So if we see these as obstacles to get over, you know, so we can finally do the practice, then it can feel very discouraging. You know, that's when things start to get very dark. Luckily, there's another way to think about it. You know, so the principle here, and I think what we've been talking about in different ways, is that whenever there's struggle, whenever there's some conflict in the body or the mind, this is what we turn toward. You know, this becomes our practice. You know, this practice ultimately comes to non-clinging, not to cling, not to be in conflict, not to hold on. So any sense of struggle is a sign that something is being held onto. Something needs to be released. There's some clinging that wants to be seen and released. So yesterday, Gil talked about the two kinds of statues. You know, the perfect Buddha is, you know, serene and beautiful and dignified and up there. And then these very human, very realistic statues, the arhats. You know, the bent over person who's, you know, whose face reveals the years of suffering and struggle. And so it's interesting to look at which do we prefer, you know. in a way, it's pointing to how easy it is for us to get hung up on an ideal. Some kind of ideal, some kind of expectation, you know, about how things should be. You know, I should be able to stay with every breath. I should be over this, you know, old painful story or painful memory. I shouldn't be so judgmental and critical of myself or others. And the kind of amazing thing about this practice, the inspiring thing to me about this practice, is whenever there's a gap, whenever there's some separation between the ideal versus the actual, we choose the actual. You know, we choose reality, you know. We let go of all those ideas and all those shoulds, and we enter into how things are. You know, the actual experience that we're having. And the reason is because, you know, the ideal doesn't exist. It's just an ideal. And it's a setup for suffering. And, you know, there's not a perfect sitting or a perfect teacher or, you know, good luck looking for those perfect parents. you know, so when we enter the actual, when we enter into our difficulties, you know, and we begin to see them and we include them in our practice, include them as ourself, that's when the practice really begins. You know, that's when the retreat really begins. So, you know, when we're living our life, when we're out in the world, because we're so active, because we move around so much, it's not easy to see our minds clearly and directly. And so part of the way this practice works, putting ourselves in this position, into this stillness, this quiet, without a lot of external distractions, is it provides us a reference point. You know, you know, in trying to be still, in trying to be mindful, we get to see all the ways that the mind gets pulled away. We get to see all these forces of distraction and preoccupation, which are hard to see when we're very busy doing many things. You know, these are the forces that make it difficult to simply be here. So the strongest of these forces, the most powerful of these forces in the mind, are given a special name. You know, so the Buddha calls them the hindrances. I think just about in every Vipassana retreat there's a talk on the hindrances because they're so important. It's like, you know, these are literally what prevents us from seeing. These are what prevent us from being mindful and being concentrated. It's not like there's a big mystery that, you know, who knows why I can't, you know, just be present and mindful. You know, we know why. It's these five factors of mind, these five forces of the mind. So if we want to be mindful, if we want to deepen our samadhi, you know, cultivate these five factors of samadhi, factors of wholeheartedness. It's really worth getting to know these hindrances. It's like we become experts on how the hindrances work in our own mind, our own heart. So these five the Buddha identified are a sensual desire, ill will, anger, ill will, the third one is usually translated as sloth and torpor, you know, it's kind of laziness, and then restlessness and worry and doubt. And they're easy to remember because they're pairs of opposites. You know, desire and ill will is wanting and then not wanting, rejecting. Sloth and torpor, the energy is too little energy. And then restlessness and worry, too much energy in a way, too activated energy. And then doubt. So just to say a few words about these hindrances in general, in and of themselves, a hindrance is not a problem. Desire is not a problem. The problem is when we don't see them. And when we don't see a hindrance as a hindrance, it controls us. It blocks our ability to see clearly. It distorts our perception. So it's said that these forces in the mind, these hindrances, they operate in everyone. You know, unless someone has uprooted them, you know, they're present. They're part of our humanity. So it's very helpful to see them as a kind of universal quality and not to take them personally. You know, not to take their presence as some kind of personal failing or, you know, some terrible uniqueness. One of the most painful forms of suffering is isolation, you know, feeling isolated. And it can be terribly isolating to feel like you're the only one struggling with something. So you're not the only one. You know, we all have these. These are aspects of our humanness. And it's one of the keys to working with them is seeing it as this impersonal quality that it's, you know, it's just doubt. It's just anger. It's just, you know. So these color and distort our perception. You know, so much so that it's recommended not to make important decisions when you're under the influence of a hindrance. You know, it's almost as if deciding to wait until you know. You have a really important life decision to make, but, you know, let me wait until I'm really drunk, you know, really intoxicated. Then and then I'll decide, you know, but when we're drunk with desire or drunk with anger or, you know, it distorts our decision making. So these hindrances are visitors to the mind. They come and they go. You know, even if you think you're a person who's just filled with lust, you know, or filled with anger, or the laziest meditator who ever, you know, walked into IRC. you're not, you know. And so part of working with these is to tune in and to notice when the hindrance is not present, when it's absent, you know, and to let that register. What it feels like to not be anxious, what it feels like to not be angry. So a strong hindrance is useful data about ourselves. You know, it's how we find out about ourselves. It's how we're seeing what makes us tick. So there's a way of working with the hindrances that they can be an opportunity. It's like, oh, that's interesting. This memory brings up really strong aversion, really strong anger. And so following on this, the principle is that when a hindrance is recurring, you know, and comes back again and again, it has something to tell us. You know, there's something that needs to be perhaps listened to in a deep way, you know, to be seen, to be listened to. You know, if we don't listen to it, it will just come back again and again and again and again. You know, that's the nature of it. So a hindrance can be incredibly powerful and kind of overpowering, such as an addiction. Or it can be something very mild and very subtle, you know, just a little bit of leaning forward, of wanting something more. Your mind is calm, but just so retreat practice can become a laboratory for us. It's like, you know, a way to encounter these forces directly, and it's this wonderful opportunity. You know, one of the classical ways to be on retreat is to kind of play with these, you know, as if it's something, you know, if you're used to having coffee every morning, you can give up coffee and then just see, you know, just see what happens, see what it's like. And, so the whole container here, are just continual opportunities, for seeing, you know, our minds. You know, we get to the lunch line and then we see, you know, is there comparing? Is there judging? Is there, and the principle is that the more practiced we are at noticing these hindrances, you know, in the meditation and on the retreat, the more we can see them in our everyday life and see how they operate. You know, so just to say again, you know, rather than ignoring the hindrance or indulging it, we seek to understand it, you know, and to meet it with mindfulness, you know, to meet it with these qualities of attention, vitaka vichara, you know, connect to the experience of being angry, as opposed to the story about my anger or the object of my anger. Connect to the experience of desiring. You know, what is it like to be, you know, that leaning forward, that wanting? We think of desire as pleasant, and there's an aspect of it that's pleasant, but if you tune into the experience of desire, you know, it's often not pleasant. it's interesting, you know. So just to play with it. You know, so desire is the first on this list. The Pali is a kama chanda, and this is defined as clinging in a compulsive way to sense pleasure, you know, craving for sense pleasure. And, you know, so this is a really big one. One of my teachers always says, desire makes the world go round. And the idea here is desire itself is not a problem. But when they become compulsions or cravings or addictions, these can disconnect us. You know, they hinder our ability to see clearly. You know, so in meditation, this often takes the form of fantasies, you know, around food or comfort or sex. And sensual desire is by its nature seductive. You know, so we get up from sitting. I mean, even, you know, very, very simple, innocent thing, you know, get up from sitting and we go over to do a walking, and then we have the idea, you know, a cup of tea would be really nice. You know, and then there's no reflection. I mean, there's no like, oh, pleasant, you know, desire, pleasant. It's just before we know it, we're looking for the milk for our tea that we already made, you know. And then we're sitting, and then, you know, just sitting there, and then it's like, well, there's not really that much time for walking. Maybe I should go back to my room and, you know, stretch a little, you know. It's what happened? You know, so desire is amazing. You know, and so the principle here is, when we're not mindful of the desire as it arises, or we're not mindful of the pleasant quality to it, we just go for it. So the classic example of this, you know, here on retreat, is something called the Vipassana Romance. If you've ever heard of this, the VR. As we call it. This is when, you know, there's that someone, you know, who, you know, the big meditation hall, but there's someone who's catches our eye, is attractive, you know. And then we start to project all this, you know, other stuff. You know, we don't know the person at all. We've never spoken to the person. Start to put all these fantasies, all these projections onto the person. And, you know, there can be this imaginary relationship, you know, this imaginary connection. And it's really common. And it's, you know, you know, so it's the mind under the influence of this hindrance, sensual desire. And, you know, as I said, it's one of the reasons it's powerful is because it's conditioned by something that's so basic, pleasant and unpleasant. You know, we go towards what's pleasant and we go away from what's unpleasant. And, you know, so sensual desire can operate on both sides. It's like if we smell, you know, you smell fresh baked cookies or something, then it's like, oh, you know, oh, that's a... So that's pretty straightforward. But also, it's like, if there's something unpleasant in the meditation, you know, like a physical pain, like a knee pain, or some kind of emotional pain, what better way to escape that unpleasantness by replacing it with something that's pleasant? You know, so we replace it with, you know, some juicy fantasy or some, you know, some kind of planning or something about the future that gives us this great warm feeling. You know, it's a kind of comfort food for the mind. So ways of working with this hindrance. So the first strategy suggested by the Buddha is simply to know it as desire. You know, we're not judging it. It's not something that's bad. It's just something to be seen. You see, you know, recognize it as desire. Because there's something in the moment of knowing it that we're not caught by it. You know, it's a way of bringing forth the mind that is not clinging, that's not identified with it. So it's impersonal, you know, okay, it's just desire. And so the other strategy is this, when desire is present, we tend to be focused on the object of desire, which makes sense. But there's a way of working with desire, which is turning the attention, you know, turning the vitaka and vichara, instead of really, you know, I'm thinking about this person who's attractive, and then, okay, so I'll just meditate on her for, so, you know, and like imagine, visualize, you know, that's very unproductive for the meditation. rather, it's you turning the mind around to feel what it's like to be desiring, to feel that energy. One example, just, you know, from my single days, you know, I remember the experience of going into like kind of a, you know, singles bar or whatever, you know, club or something. And, you know, at first there's kind of this excitement, wow, there's all these great people here and this, you know, kind of excitement. But then as the desire started to generate, you know, I could just feel this, it was just a kind of a sadness about it, of just the kind of this so I was so disconnected from myself, it's like leaning forward, leaning out, wanting something. I didn't know what I want, but something, someone's attention or something. You know. And that's that, you know, to tune into that energy. You know, it's actually not pleasant to be in the grip of a compulsion. You know, so here on retreat, how we guard the sense doors is a big help, you know. We don't make so much eye contact, we don't look around. We're not taking in other things, surfing the web, doing these things. And, you know, so that as well is helpful in helping to prevent this hindrance from arising. So the second hindrance is considered the opposite of sensual desire. This is ill will, you know, sometimes translated as aversion. Bhikkhu Bodhi defines this as attitudes of resistance, rejection, and destruction. It includes the whole range from minor irritation and annoyance to fear and grief to sorrow and to, you know, rage, basically, and hatred. One of the things that I found interesting is that even the mild forms of ill will are said to be rooted in this, in dosa, you know, this root defilement, which means hatred. You know, so this is, again, this is present in all of us. This is a universal aspect of our humanity. And it's conditioned from the basic human impulse to reject. You know, to get away from what we find unpleasant. you know, from what we find painful. So here on retreat, one of the first ways we see this is through physical pain. You know, it's as we're asking our bodies to do something that we're not used to doing, you know, to put ourselves in this position. And it generates a certain discomfort, a certain pain, and then we get to see how we relate to it. We get to, you know, watch our minds. And so our conditioned reaction to pain is usually to contract around it, to tighten around it, physically and mentally. We contract and resist and become impatient and frustrated and discouraged. You know, so and in the same way, we contract around mental pain, unpleasant thoughts. So we talked about the Vipassana romance, and it follows that there's another phenomenon that yogis have noticed, which is called the Vipassana vendetta. This is when we take all those negative feelings, all that frustration, you know, all that darkness, and we just, you know, put it on, you know, someone. And, you know, they become the focus of our aversion, and it will. You know, it's like first we notice one thing about the person. You know, they're doing something we don't really like what they're doing, and then we just notice everything they do is wrong. You know, and everything about this person annoys us, and so what we don't see is that we're going through something that's difficult, we're going through something that's unpleasant, and we just put it all on another person who we don't know at all. And, you know, and there's something about anger that can feel good as well. There's a seductiveness to anger. There's a payoff to anger. The Buddha called it the poisoned root with a honey tip. The poisoned root with a honey tip. So it's this, you know, there's this sweetness to it. So how to work with this hindrance? You know, in the most basic way, again, we just bring our mindfulness to it. We see anger as anger. We see annoyance as annoyance. You know, it's so interesting that it's possible to be really annoyed, but never, you know, just never, oh, wow, I'm really irritated right now. You know, it's so easy to be in the grip of it and looking through it, but not to just a simple acknowledgement. You know, as we've been saying, emotions have all these dimensions, the physical dimension, the energetic dimension, as well as the story, the cognitive dimension. So it can be incredibly useful to find it in the body, get out of the story, and let this most stable base of the pyramid, you know, hold our anger, hold our ill will. This is from Thich Nhat Hanh. The Buddhist attitude is to take care of anger. We don't suppress it. We don't run away from it. We just breathe and hold our anger in our arms with utmost tenderness. Then the anger is no longer alone. It is with your mindfulness. Anger is like a closed flower in the morning. As the sun shines on the flower will bloom, because the sunlight penetrated deep into the flower. Mindfulness is like that. If you keep breathing, mindfulness particles will infiltrate the anger. The flower cannot resist. Your anger will soon crack. You will soon be able to look into its depths and see its roots. So, you know, and as we've said, it's anger can often be, you know, in a way, it's as difficult as anger is. It's easier to experience anger, perhaps, than to experience what's fueling the anger, you know, the sadness, the vulnerability, the fear, the hurt. So, you know, a lot of patience, a lot of kindness, loving kindness, compassion. These qualities can counter and neutralize, you know, this force of ill will. So the third hindrance is this sloth and torpor. This is like the dullness in the mind, lethargic quality of mind. It's especially common at the beginning of retreat. You know, we talked about this because we come into the retreat and we're usually carrying sleep debt, and then we don't have all our usual sources of stimulation. So, you know, it's just gets sleepy and lethargic. You know, as the retreat progresses and we've adjusted and we've slept and we've the presence of sloth and torpor often indicates something else. You know, it can be a kind of a pulling back, a kind of resistance to feeling what we're feeling. Or resistance to dealing with something that's unpleasant. So with sloth and torpor, the energy is still there, but we're cut off from it. We don't have access to it. One of my teachers describes this as the mind that loves the snooze button on the alarm. You know, it's like just five more. You know, just that. It has this feeling called, it's cozy, it's comfortable, it's seductive, it's, you know. This is also one of the hindrances that masquerades as wisdom. You know, it's like, oh, I'm too tired to go to the last sitting, I just need to take care of myself, and, you know. Maybe, you know, sleep would be good. But it's, you know, it's interesting. It's so the traditional ways of countering this involve arousing energy, an inspiration for practice. We get really interested in the experience of sloth and torpor. You know, what does it feel like? What are the sensations in the body and the mind? We turn our vitaka vichara towards it. And then the various ways of increasing energy, which we've talked about, doing more walking meditation, walking faster, standing. So that's kind of to physically arouse the energy. To arouse the mind, it can be very helpful to remember and recall why we're practicing, why we're doing this, and kind of to touch into our deeper motivations, aspirations. So that's sloth and torpor. And then the other side of that is restlessness and worry. This is too much jittery energy, feeling unsettled, agitated, hyperactive. You know, the physical restlessness is pretty easy to see, and it's really common. You know, we're not used to being this still. And then the mental restlessness, you know, it can take a few different forms. One thing that's very common among yogis is there can be a kind of obsessiveness that, you know, we can kind of start to think about something. And then, you know, I've been on retreat sometimes, you know, going into a longer retreat, and then I just start thinking, I should have brought that jacket. You know, I should have brought that jacket. I should have brought that jacket. I should have brought that jacket. You know, every time I go out, I think, oh, I don't have the right, you know. And then thinking about it, okay, well, maybe I'll leave a note to the manager to get my friend to mail a box and, you know, with my jacket. You know, and then I think, okay, this is great. You know, because I brought two other jackets, right? I mean, this is crazy. And just leave it. And then you just forget all about it. It's not, you know, it's not anything. So a kind of obsessiveness, this hindrance can take the form. And then the other thing is we sometimes talk about on retreats, this idea of yogi mind. You know, yogi mind is the mind that blows things out of proportion. You know, so it's like, I don't know of any examples from this retreat, I'm just thinking of. But, you know, the kind of, you know, just, you know, I once got a note from what was the note? It was the note, it was like, you know, the yogi sat all the way in the back of a big meditation hall, but was concerned about the particular kind of candle that was on the altar, or the particular kind of, you know, it was something like that. Or it was, I'll give an example from my own practice. I've left a note for teacher complaining about the sound of someone's breathing. You know, it's something we can relate to. And, you know, I sat with it, I practiced with it, I did all these things. And then finally, I wrote a furious note. But the note was not, I wasn't blaming the person, it was blaming the teachers. Because they're not in the meditation hall, why aren't they there? Why aren't they, you know, in Zen, the teachers sit with the students and are really watching everything, and they're not watching. And, you know, so, kind of crazy note. And then, I put it on the board, and I had a little twinge of like, is this a good idea? But I thought, anyway, just, I did it. And then I kept going back, you know, waiting to see the response. You know, I kind of circle around. Nothing. First afternoon, nothing. That, oh, I said, well, surely that evening, nothing. The next day, nothing. And then I kind of got it after, you know, I was like, oh yeah, maybe, yeah, I don't know. Just let it go. Just let it go. It was never mentioned, never, you know. You know, this can especially come up around this time of the retreat. It's like there's a certain time of the retreat where, you know, you're in the heart of it, and it's not at the beginning and it's not at the end, and, you know, everything's churning and everything is moving. You know, so one of the ways of countering restlessness and worry is making a special effort to cultivate stillness. You know, if this is the kind of agitated energy, you know, giving special attention to stillness. And one of the dynamics involved here is that on retreat, often, you know, out of the stillness comes memories or reminders of unskillful things we've done in the past. You know, so that kind of regret, you know, worry, regret. At one point when I was on retreat, I started keeping a list of all the people I had to apologize to. You know, because it was just, I couldn't remember them all. You know, and yet, you know, and then part of it might be yogi mind, but part of it is like, you know, it's just we're becoming more sensitive, and we're, you know, and just, you know, you know, so something about seeing unskillfulness that we've done in the past learning from it and letting go of it is a really important part of the practice. And it's a part of the purification that the path offers. And then there's a way that we can reflect with happiness on how we are now, you know, how, you know, that we're not repeating those same mistakes, you know. And sometimes it's skillful to make amends in some way, you know, so you can explore that. And often just to say that it's sometimes the restlessness is so strong that it's just a victory to stay on the cushion, you know, or it's just a victory to stay in the meditation hall and not to worry about, you know, looking good or doing this or that. It's like really just, you know, hanging in there is great. So the final hindrance is doubt. And doubt can be very difficult to see when we're caught inside it. It can be doubt about the teaching, doubt about the practice, doubt about the teacher, doubt about the Buddha, the Dharma. So doubt involves some kind of lack of trust in what we're doing here. You know, so when a sitting is difficult, and when something is difficult, I thought, you know, why are we doing this again? You know, what's the, you know, this is a waste, you know. How can this help? I have all these problems. Or we have some doubt about how we're meditating. You know, we keep changing, you know, well, should I be with the breath? Should I be with it? You know, or how should I be with the breath? Or what's that instruction again? Or, you know, so every sitting we're changing, different. That's often doubt, expression of doubt. And it's very interesting, even when the meditation is going very well and things are very calm and still and refined, there can be this little voice of like, you know, you're not really doing it, or this isn't, you know, this isn't happening. So, you know, it's like, what? It's, you know, and doubt can be very, very convincing. This is the most convincing, you know. You know, why do we believe this voice? It's, you know, one time when I was on retreat, you know, this is the thing that sold me on the benefits of recognizing doubt. I was on retreat and doing a kind of concentration practice that was bringing up a lot of difficult sensations and emotions. And I just had the idea that I'm not going to do this. This isn't for me. This is not a good idea. Is this even safe? Is this even, you know, had all these ideas. So I went into the teacher and I kind of told her, you know, I'm not doing this. And, you know, I don't think this is a good idea. And she just had this big smile on her face. And it's like, huh? So this big smile on her face. And she just pointed and she just said, doubt. And it was a stunning, it was like, oh, this is doubt, you know, this is just doubt. And, you know, and she was modeling, you know, how you can just, you know, so easily just, you know, it just changes everything. It's like, oh, this is just doubt. You know, this is just sadness. This is just irritation. This is just anger. This is just regret. This is just desire. You know. And so it's said that what counters doubt is cultivating the qualities of faith, qualities of trust. Trust in ourselves, trust in the practice. And we build that trust through our experience, you know. You know, the more we're able to hang in there with our difficulties, the more confidence we have in ourselves, the more confidence that we have the capacity to hold this. You know, it's not unmanageable. And that builds trust and that builds faith. And as we see and we start to see that through mindfulness, through connecting over and over again, it has the power to transform this and kind of disengage us, disidentify us, and free us in a certain way from these we start to grow a lot of faith, a lot of trust. So these five hindrances are said to have a special relationship with the five jhanic factors we've been talking about. It's like, in a way, I don't want to call the hindrances poison, but the hindrances, these five jhanic factors are like the antidote to the five hindrances, or are the response, or are the way that we meet the hindrances, and and learn to see through them and learn to let them go. So, I mean, it's just kind of interesting which one corresponds to which. So, vitaka, this connecting, is said to correspond to sloth and torpor. And if you think about it, you know, vitaka, this connecting, is the most active, the most energizing one. We connect over and over to the body, connect to the breath, connect to our sadness. We connect, and that changes the energy, you know, from this dullness. It brightens the mind over and over. We brighten. So vitaka, which is this sustaining, is said to overcome doubt. And you can just, you know, and just, it's not, this is just, you know, kind of to explore. Gil talked about the joy and the happiness, the pitti and the sukha. So the pitti, this kind of intense physical joy overcomes the ill will, the anger. You know, and having a deep experience of joy that comes from within can somehow, sometimes serve to reset those pathways, those that are stuck in aversion. And then sukha, happiness, overcoming restlessness. One of the ways I think about this happiness is it can be just a kind of ease, you know. And these are moments that we all have, you know, just to savor that ease, savor that peacefulness. It's like a... And there's a stillness to it, there's a relaxing to it that overcomes the restlessness. And then the fifth jhanic factor, one-pointedness of mind or unification of mind, is said to overcome sensual desire. And there's a... So one of the wonderful ways that the practice can unfold is that as the hindrances begin to fade, and as these factors of wholeheartedness kind of take their place and become prominent, there can be this you know, wonderful lightness. You know, this lightness that we haven't experienced before, because we're so used to living with the hindrances. You know, they've been kind of weighing us down, but we never knew, because we're just accustomed to them. So when they're absent, you know, it can be quite wonderful. You know, so these are the five hindrances. You know, one way of seeing them as that, you know, these are in a way they're trying to help us. You know, if you think about, you know, they're strategies to help us avoid something that, you know, we don't want to experience. So you know, strategies of avoidance, or, you know, or ways that we've learned to cope, ways that we've learned to relate, which may have had their use, but we may have outgrown them. They may have outgrown their usefulness. You know, so something about meeting them with a lot of kindness, a lot of care, a lot of respect. I just wanted to end with this short story, which illustrates so well the importance of relating to the part of us that's in conflict, the conflicted part of us, with care, with respect. You know, because this is often our best effort, you know, has been our best effort to protect ourselves. You know, so it's like we build these walls around our heart, and then we wonder why we can't feel love. So this is a story. Some of you, I'm sure, know it. It's about the Japanese, you know, after the war. You know, the 10, 20 years after the war, and all the islands in the South Pacific, the Philippines, the Japanese surrendered and returned to Japan. But, you know, these islands are filled with jungles. And there were soldiers who were deep in the jungle who couldn't be found and who weren't told that the hostilities had ended. And so in a way they were left there, they were abandoned. And then years later, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years later, local people, villagers, came across the soldiers. And you know, the small number of loyal soldiers who had hidden in caves and forests, you know, and they continue to hold their positions, you know, continue to be fighting the war. So they viewed themselves as good soldiers who were defending their country, and they had no idea that the war was over. So one might wonder how these men were treated when they were finally found after 10 or 15 years. They were not considered misguided or fools. Instead, when one of these soldiers was located, the first contact was always made very carefully. Someone who had been a high-ranking Japanese officer during the war would put on his old uniform and his samurai sword and take an old military boat over to this place where the person was. And the officer would walk through the jungle calling out for the soldier by name, you know, until he was found. And then when they met, the officer, with tears in his eyes, would thank the soldier for his loyalty and courage, continuing to defend his country for so many years. Then he would ask him about his experiences and welcome him back. Only after some time would the soldier gently be told that the war was over and his country was at peace again, so he would not have to fight anymore. When he reached home, he would be given an honorable welcome, celebrating his struggle and his return and his reunion with his people. They weren't shamed, they weren't ridiculed, they weren't told, you know, you're damaged now, or why are you still fighting this battle? But, you know, met with this expression of otsukare sama deshita, you know, thank you for your efforts, thank you for trying to protect us, you know, and it's okay now, and, you know, the war is over. So it's one of the questions that I think all of us come to at some point or another in our practice is, what are the wars that we're still fighting? And, you know, can we bow to the part of ourselves that's still in conflict? Thank you for trying to protect me. And let the war be over, and free ourselves in that way. If we just sit a minute. Let the words float away. Whatever difficulties we face, may we meet them with the heart of kindness and compassion, and find our freedom right in the midst of this wonderful, difficult life, just as we are.